Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hello and welcome to the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast. It's your host, Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez. I am a sports dietitian, entrepreneur, podcast host, mother, and lifelong athlete myself. Today I'm here with our guest, Becca Wendell. She is a wildlife biologist, trail and ultra runner, trail and ultra running coach as well. And this was just a really nice episode where Beck and I just got to ask her about her story, you know, about getting into sport that started off with cycling and is now ultra running, and her journey with nutrition along the way, which went down the path of an eating disorder due to sort of the environment that she was in of competitive cycling. And she has since not only recovered, but really reframed her mindset around fueling and really just found a happy place with her relationship with food and relationship with sport once again, specifically running as she got into that. I just really enjoyed getting to know Becca, and she is a really impressive runner. She has the golden ticket for Western States 100, which is coming up in June. So she's really quite impressive to watch. And we did chat actually about her coaches who have helped her in her training over the last few years. Actually, David Roach and his wife, David and Megan Roach, were actually guests on the Female Athlete Nutrition Podcast. We chatted about that briefly, and I just wanted you as listeners to know, if you want to get to know them more, they were way back in episode number 35. I can't believe it was that long ago. But episode number 35, if you want to hear about their approach to training distance and ultra runners, including Becca, who's one of their athletes and has found success with their training program. Before we hear from Becca, I just want to remind you of some discounts and deals that you might want to take advantage of as a listener of this podcast. Today's episode is thanks to Prevenex, clinically tested nutritional supplements, including multivitamins, immune health, omega plus probiotics, joint health, and plant-based nutritional powders. There are so many supplements to choose from. I have many that I do recommend to clients and listeners, but I do also take Prevenex myself, specifically the joint health supplement. Actually, crazy enough, my husband takes it. He told me just this past weekend, he said, "I got to tell you, Linz, I don't know if it's, you know, something else I'm doing, but my joints aren't hurting me as much as they used to. I think it's that supplement." And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, you didn't change anything else. He's not sleeping any better. He's not stretching more. There's a lot more that he probably could and should do." But he's been taking that supplement consistently now for about 6 months, and I've been taking it for a bit longer than that. And I'm actually shocked to say that it's working, not just for me, but now for him. I say I'm shocked because I'm a foods first dietitian, and there's so many things to take care of our health. You know, one supplement cannot cure everything, but I really am amazed at the quality of Prevenex's joint health supplement. It is using a specific type of eggshell membrane that has quite a few vitamins, minerals, and collagen in it. And I really do feel the difference. I was struggling with arthritis and exercise-induced joint pain, and my husband as well, with many years of pushing his body physically as active duty armed forces. His joints have been through the ringer, and we're both really amazed by this. So if you would like to give Prevenex a shot, their joint health, or any of their other supplement products, it is a brand that I think very highly of as a dietitian. You can use the code RISEUP for 15% off. Rise up for 15% off Prevenex. That's www.prevenex.com. Use the code RISEUP for 15% off. This episode is also brought to you by Practice Better. This is the platform that I use as a registered dietitian. You can also use it as a health coach or any sort of coach or health professional in order to conduct your practice, your business, your private practice. If you have clients that you need to book in on your calendar, if you need a way to send invoices, to write up client notes and charting, Practice Better is the better way to manage your practice. I've been using it since the inception of doing private practice. We're going on 6 years now. I just think there's so many different platforms out there for charting, scheduling, invoicing, and this is by far the best one, especially as a dietitian. I think you can use it in many different ways as just a health professional, but specific to nutrition. This is the best one. Its founder was a dietitian herself. So that tells you she had a vision in mind when creating it. You can use the code RISEUP20 for 20% off of your subscription to Practice Better. I would urge you to go to the show notes and follow the link that's included. That link is specific in order to capitalize on the 20% off. Use the code RISEUP20 by following the link in the show notes, and you'll get 20% off of your subscription. By the way, that does include a 14-day free trial to test it out and see how it might work for you as a coach or provider. Again, these are just a couple of companies that I affiliate myself with because they have been so helpful in my life and in the life of my clients and athletes. And as a fan and listener of this podcast, I want you to have the opportunity to explore it if you so wish as well. Without further ado, let's get to the episode with Becca. Becca, a wildlife biologist, trail ultra running coach, and avid runner yourself. Thank you so much for being willing to come on. And I'm just so excited to meet you.
You bet, Lindsay. I'm really excited to chat with you today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we're going to get into all things athletics and nutrition soon, but I was on your website and just reading about your job. Are you currently still pursuing your PhD?
I am, yeah.
In wildlife, yeah. And I was looking at the things that you've published, like just, what's your focus with wildlife? Is it you're right now on deer? Like, how did you get to that?
Yeah, it's been a little
bit. Very specific.
It is very specific. So animal behavior is what has always fascinated me.
Yeah.
And there's some really cool applications for wildlife behavior in especially management and conservation issues. So A lot of my background's in carnivore ecology and behavior in terms of human carnivore conflict and just trying to foster coexistence. And then I've recently made this jump into the current project that I'm working on is a deer disease study.
Yeah.
So chronic wasting disease is a disease that affects the deer family here in North America. Mule deer in particular get hit pretty hard.
Yeah.
But so there's some really interesting behavioral implications in terms of disease progression. So it's been a really fascinating place to try to apply behavior to a whole different context.
Yeah, for sure. And I was reading articles and research that you've been a part of. And like the word carnivore was written on there so many times. And I think that's I don't know. For some reason, I was like, that sounds intense, you know, like, and animals, living things, carnivores or omnivores, whatever. But like, there's something that just seemed really intense about it. I was like, oh, you're out in the wild and you're up in Colorado. My sister actually went to CSU and got her PhD there as well. Not in environmental science, epidemiology.
So okay.
She, I think in her beginning studies, did a little bit of wildlife work and then kind of went a different route, more epidemiology, toxicology stuff. But yeah, I was like, this is so fascinating. And you're out there as a trail runner. I'm sure that this, two very different things. And yet you're out there in nature kind of respecting, you know, what nature is doing. And that's what it seems like with your work with the animals as well, is just like, how do we let them do their thing and support that, you know, prevent disease progression, help them coexist?
Yeah.
Does it feel like that when you're running, that you're like two different things, but on a similar mission in some sense?
Totally. I feel, yeah, really grateful. Like, I love my job. I absolutely adore it. And I think a lot of that is just the fact that I can be outside really interacting with the things that I'm actively thinking about on a day-to-day basis. So it is pretty cool. Like, I wouldn't say I have my life compartmentalized in that way. It is kind of all integrated, which is really nice. Yeah. So feel fortunate for that.
Yeah. And I think another really cool thing as I was kind of preparing to meet you and everything was just remembering sometimes, like I said, I had seen you on social media with some of your runs and recent wins and things like that before we asked you to become a guest on the podcast. And it's just nice then when you like realize like, oh, these people have other interests besides just their sport or just running, and you're incredibly smart and knowledgeable, and you just have so much to offer, right? So it's awesome to look up to you as an amazing runner, and then it's awesome to see all these other interests and things that you are pursuing and making the world a better place for all the deer.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a cool part about our sport. I also am so inspired by it. There's so many incredible people in this sport doing just amazing things. And yeah, bringing together a lot of, I feel like it's a really passionate group of humans who are generally doing a lot of cool things in addition to running.
Yeah, and the trail running community too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to get to your running in a little bit. But actually, I learned that it wasn't always running for you. You were a very high-level elite cyclist for quite some time. In your late teens and early 20s, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. Tell us about where your passion for cycling began and just that trajectory of, you know, the decisions you made as a young adult and young athlete to pursue high-level cycling.
Yeah. So I grew up in the city of Chicago, pretty much downtown. So knew, always liked being outside. We didn't have a ton of, I guess, outdoor recreation opportunities, at least in like the exploration sense of things. And that was something that did always call to me as a young kid. So yeah, I have this distinct memory of riding the bus to school probably in seventh or eighth grade and just seeing these people biking, like bike commuting past our bus flying by, you know, Chicago traffic. The bus was usually stopped and took like pretty long time to get to school.
The bike is going faster than the bus. Yeah.
Bike was definitely going faster than the bus. And that was something I took note of. And so, yeah, started in eighth grade bike commuting to school for the first time. And, you know, I would get there in about a quarter of the time that the bus would take me.
Wow.
And that really started to open my world to all the places the bike could take me. And yeah, it was really incredible at that initial stage. So I definitely in high school started to get more and more into biking, but first just as a way of exploring. We had a great lakefront path in Chicago. That was some of the first longer rides I'd do. Yeah, and just, I don't know. It's just a really cool way to see my city and get to know it and just kind of like continuously break boundaries in terms of like how far I could go. Because there's just places we would like drive in the car and I remember it taking forever and then realizing I could bike there. So that was pretty cool.
Bike gave you that freedom at a young age.
It did. Yeah.
This is really reminiscent, actually, of I got to meet and do an episode with Molly Herford, who is an author and also a cyclist. And she felt that way, too. She got into cycling at a young age because it gave her freedom and she got to get from point A to B, you know, before you can drive and you got to explore. And I love that reason behind it, especially coming from kind of city life as well. It's really important.
Yeah, it was, pretty formative to especially my high school years. So I feel really grateful for it.
Yeah.
So, then through that, I started to build some community in Chicago. First of all, I got kind of obsessed. I was very interested in the bike messenger culture in Chicago. So there's a whole, I guess there's businesses is probably the best way to describe it of people who are currying packages between office buildings
and
downtown cities. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So as a high schooler, that was like something I was just sort of infatuated with.
Yeah.
Was these people who were, you know, not only riding around the city, but like doing it in a pretty, at least in my mind, very cool way.
Yeah.
When I was 15 years old. Like, so that got me into, there were some little kind of informal bike messenger races that I would take part in.
Wow.
And yeah, so long story short, that got me into realizing that bike racing was a thing, and it just sort of expanded from there.
Yeah, very cool. So again, city life, it wasn't this like traditional, I'm going to join the sports team, but this is how the city operated. Bikes took packages from here to there and you did that and then got faster and faster.
Yep.
That's so fun. Okay, so at what age did you realize or like become serious about it in regards to a sport?
Yeah, so I probably did my first official bike race when I was 16 or so, and I had pretty good success with it right away. So I will say like that definitely sparked my motivation to, you know, keep putting more and more time into the sport.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I guess at that stage, it started to transition from just this vehicle of exploring the city and I guess a tool for freedom and finding all of that as a city youth. And then, getting more and more serious about racing. So traded my like kind of grungy messenger clothes for a lot of more spandex. And that was sort of the trajectory of seriousness was more and more spandex.
More spandex you have, the more serious you are in sport.
Yeah, exactly.
That. Very cool. And then am I getting your background right in that you pursued high level sport instead of college? That's a big decision.
Yeah, so I went to one. It was a big decision. In hindsight, yeah, I don't know. I don't regret it by any means. But yeah, by the time I was 18, senior year of high school, really enthralled with bike racing. So I did go to college for a semester down at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado.
Okay.
Because that university had, or college had, the best cycling team in the country. So very cycling focused. But then after a semester or so, I left school and decided to, because I'd gotten a professional contract racing bikes and did that for the next 6 years or so.
Wow.
Which was a wild adventure.
Yeah. Do you think that doing that semester in college helped gain that professional contract, or were you gaining the interest and having people reach out to you before that?
Yeah, it was sort of just a, I guess, right time, right place for everything.
Yeah.
During that first semester, I had my best result. I'd gone to the Junior World Championships and performed really well there.
Yeah.
And then one of the team managers for the team I ended up riding for, just because Durango is such a hub for cycling, lived there as well. So they sort of went hand in hand in terms of going on that trajectory.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, great. So 6 years as a professional cyclist at that young age. And was that stateside or were you overseas?
Yeah, I raced both domestically and internationally.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I do generally half the year in the States and then half the year, mostly in Europe, but a few, sometimes there are other places we travel as well.
Did you have family go with you, or were you really on your own?
Pretty on my own. Yeah. Wow. So I was, again, going back to biking as a kid, like it was something that gave me a lot of independence from a young age. So to my mom's credit, like that was, I was pretty strong headed about, just wanted to do a lot of it on my own. But yeah, definitely looking back, like pretty wild to be traveling and doing things at such a young age. Kind of.
Yeah, I think when you are that age, we feel, we feel invincible and capable and, but when you get older, you look back and you're like, that was really young to do that,
Totally.
Because, as you get older, you get wiser and smarter and all that. And you're just like, wow. But at that time, it's awesome that you had that confidence to do something like that.
Yeah. And I think one of my favorite things about being able to race at that level was the travel. Like travel was always something that I wanted to see the world. So it was a pretty incredible avenue to do that.
Yeah. So let's shift gears here to put a bike pun on that and chat a little bit about nutrition. You were willing to share that throughout that time, some struggles with nutrition did pop up. And I'd love to just hear from you kind of your nutrition journey, maybe what it was like as a kid versus what you were exposed to in the sport of cycling, especially as things became more serious and we wore more spandex, and kind of how what nutrition was as a child may have morphed or changed as you were diving into elite cycling.
Yeah. I mean, I think I grew up with a fairly my mom always, we ate pretty healthy in my family. I was the lone vegetarian, so I was given a lot of cans of beans to eat in lieu of whatever meat was on the table. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like had pretty good childhood, I think great healthy diet and good memories and context around food. And that was something that I really didn't think about at all until I started to probably get into more and more of that spandex wearing mm-hmm. phase of life. Cycling, I mean, with it being such a beautiful sport, I think one of the downfalls sometimes, at least culturally, is that there is so much emphasis on like the power to weight ratios in sport. So yeah, like as I got more serious, there started to be little, you know, first suggestions that were, you know, not at all meant to, I think, set me on any sort of negative trajectory with food, but just like ways that I could maybe lose a little bit of weight so that I could improve my performance, to then those suggestions just becoming like more and more explicit and me like probably holding on to them more and more tightly mm-hmm. as I became more motivated to excel in this sport. So yeah, I think when I was 16, 17, as I really started to transition getting into more serious about the sport, like I started tracking all of my calories and like being really wary of what I was taking in.
Yeah.
Probably still at like a okay level of like consumption. But then that, yeah, I guess at that world championship race, not that there's like perfect pivotal moments, but I had gotten second place mm-hmm. there. And I think the gold medal was about 5 seconds off.
Ugh.
And I had somebody, you know, I don't think at all I don't think they intended it to be as profound as it ended up being, but just, you know, stating if I would have maybe weighed a little bit less, I could have won. So at that stage, like, especially as I, you know, I became professional off of that result, I really took that to heart at that stage.
Wow.
And so, yeah, like full on, just that began probably like a gradual starting eating disorder into a lot more full blown.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Journey through that. So.
Yeah. I'm just letting that really sink in. And, you know, what I'm hearing from you is a lot of, I don't know, what is the word? Optimism or just like grace for the other people who made those comments. Because you're right. Some people say things and we, you know, I say things to people sometimes. I don't know about what, but like that maybe is interpreted differently than intended, right? We are not responsible for other people's words. We're only responsible for how we act upon them. But with that being said, I hope that people listening to this might become more mindful of their words around weight and body size or shape or image to really anybody, but especially to the mind of a younger person who we're making those, you know, our brain is still developing at 16, 17 years old. And you're thinking, oh, you know, maybe an adult person who's, air quote, smarter, wiser than me, or so we think they are, just told me that if only I was 5 pounds less, I could have won. And actually, we have no proof that that is true. Maybe if the wind blew a different direction, you could have won. You know, there's many things that could have made that difference. There's hundreds of things that impact performance and race day, and weight is just one and certainly not the most important one. But when people say things like that, again, we're not responsible for other people's words, only how we respond to them. But I just think anybody listening to this can keep that as a reminder, be real cautious or just avoid making those comments about weight because of the path that it can set people on.
Yeah. And I think your point to especially, I mean, I think anybody, but then being extra mindful about young folks that are, especially in sport, like generally pretty motivated people who are going to take that stuff to heart one way or another too.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like once we start making comments about people's body weight and giving any sort of idea or comment that it's not ideal or could be better or improved, like that person's going to take that information one of two ways. They're going to, which your case and very common for athletes, is to take that information and do everything in their power to make sure that that's never a limiting factor again, you know? Yeah. Or that can just spiral us into depression and self-loathing and body hatred, or it's a combination of the two. Like, I just feel like people's comments about bodies just, it rarely goes well. So we just need to bite our tongue and not say anything. And I'm somebody who, I've been practicing this for years. I work in this space. I'm passionate about this. And, you know, I make a conscious effort not to comment on people's bodies, even when you think it's a compliment.
Yep, definitely.
And that can be the really hard one. Even when you think like you want to tell someone, oh, you look so good, or you look strong, or if you're thinking, oh, you lost weight and you think that's a compliment to that person. But the way somebody else can internalize that, oh, they think I look good now. What did they think of me before? Or what might they think of me in a few months if I let it go? And so it's just really, if we can just say, wow, Becca, second place, that's amazing. You know, so close. Like, let's keep training. Next time you'll get first, you know? And
yeah,
those are the things that we can say instead. It's just, yeah, those, it's really crazy how many stories I've heard that are like yours, unfortunately. And so I just really want to stress that to our listeners, especially coaches and parents, that it's performance is not directly about weight. And, you know, you brought up the point too in cycling. It's that weight to power ratio. And everybody focuses on the weight. It's a ratio, weight to power. Why don't we focus on the power aspect of it more?
Definitely.
More weight, more mass, more strength could give you more power.
Yep.
And that would make that ratio better as well. It's not always about lowering the weight. It's about increasing the power. And you can't increase power at a super low body weight. That's what the cycling community just ignores.
Yep, totally. Yeah, I was thinking about it a little bit this morning while I was running too. And I mean, beyond like that being a pivotal point in terms of really starting some very negative eating disorder behaviors that definitely like framed a lot of my time cycling, I think it also was this switch of sport being like turning from this process where I felt like I was kind of like using it to build myself up. You know, like breaking, like getting further distances and achieving new things. And just like this vehicle for self-exploration and like, what are my limits and trying to cross those, to this process of like, just trying to break myself down like more and more, you know?
Yeah.
And that just, in terms of life and in general, it's just not a fun way to live.
Mm.
Yeah. So it can just have really big context, I think, across like somebody's entire life and perspective.
Yeah, I love how you phrase that too. I think that's a moment for all of us to pause and be like, is my participation in sport and exercise, is that building me up or is this breaking me down? And for you with the nutrition piece, it began to break you down. Like literally your physical body began to break down as you became, you know, malnourished, undernourished. But it breaks us down mentally too.
Yep.
It's not as fun anymore. We have more stress. Again, going down that path of like, if it is really related to how we look or our size, there might be body hatred or going on, just negativity in the mind. And that's breaking you down more too.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, while not all of my time cycling was bad, I will say it definitely encapsulated like the darkest years of my life as well, you know, as a result. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I think one other thing I want to highlight in the story of yours is that, you know, in the beginning, maybe an awareness around nutrition, some calorie counting was harmless. And that's my story too, where it began of just an interest and being aware of what I'm eating. And it can be harmless. And sometimes it's good to learn nutrition, right? We need to learn some things. But that's where it can very quickly be a slippery slope of then using this information against you, or if you don't have the right context as to what health really is. So again, going back to that time in your life, you were aware of calorie counting on some level. It was relatively harmless until it shifted to, ooh, I need to lose some weight, therefore I need to eat less calories. And now we're using that information in a way that's not good.
Yeah.
Although you thought it was good because that was the advice you were given, right? And this is where it gets real complicated and why it can very quickly be a slippery slope into disordered eating. And I just want to bring that to people's attention because very often with athletes, we see or are watching, maybe as parents, I talk to so many parents who are like, oh, they eat so healthy. They're really aware. We're so proud of them for being conscious of their diet. And that's good. But the difference between being conscious and being obsessive or using it destructively or in a way that's harmful, it can be a really, really fine line.
Yep. Or working towards some arbitrary target too. Like, because those are always going to be arbitrary, you know, like, so that health metric and just how you feel being something to really ground towards too, in addition to what you just said. Yeah.
So as you went down a more negative path with eating and it did develop into more of an eating disorder, just what were you aware of what was happening? Were you aware that this was not good? Did you feel terrible? Or is it kind of a little bit more in hindsight?
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, amongst my peer group, like, it was just sort of the talk and culture that everybody sort of subscribed to.
It's normalized.
So really, yeah, it was very normalized. Like, everybody was getting skinny, you know, like that was something we actively talked about.
Wow.
So in that way, like, it felt very normal. And in terms of, like, restriction, I'd say initially I had a lot of pride around that, like, just being able to become smaller and smaller. And then, yeah, like, as though I progressed into some more, like, binging and purging behaviors, then I, like, started to feel a lot more shame. And that was something, it just felt like, yeah, I felt a lot of shame around that. And as that, like, got worse, kind of just got self-destructive in general. And I think because I was so embarrassed about, having an eating disorder, like, at that stage, I realized that I, like, you know, was obviously doing some very disordered things around food, not just, like, not eating.
Right.
Which, you know, is normalized in our sport.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it took me a really long time to, I think, just, like, admit that that actually was my problem to other people, too, because it's something I just tried to hide for a really long time as well.
Thank you for sharing that. I think a lot of people, because of not just the sport, but society, can glorify restriction or not eating. And we shouldn't. It's not healthy. It is disordered. It's not good.
Yeah.
But I think that's why so many people get stuck in that trap, because we do carry some pride around it. And then when the other aspects of disordered eating pop up, which very often, almost always do as a result of restriction, binging, purging, compensation can happen and does very, very often. There is a lot more shame associated with those actions. And really, it's all disordered. So I don't think one is not better than another at all.
Yep.
But it is interesting just how we carry those feelings and emotions, and talking about it is different. So I think in one sense, it highlights to us the awareness that this is a problem a little bit more, which is, it's not good, but, you know, okay, well, now we've identified it's a problem. But I also, it would be so great if people could also identify that the restriction piece of it is a problem as well before, you know.
Yeah. Because, like, to be honest, too, like, that was probably, you know, during that initial phase of, like, just losing a lot of weight, I got a lot of positive attention as a result of it, too, you know. So got really encouraged in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
As well. Yeah.
And again, going back to our conversation before about, like, it just says people in the world trying to be conscious not to make body comments. Again, that's where you were given positive praise or gratitude for the weight loss win, and that perpetuated a problem. And so, again, just trying to not say anything is the hardest thing and so important.
Yeah.
Unless you're saying something out of care and concern, of course, there comes a point, too, where you might witness a friend or a teammate that you think is struggling, and it is important to say something. That can be a very difficult and delicate conversation to have, to say, you know, I'm not sure if you're doing okay. Did you have, you said this was really normalized in your sport. So at what point did you realize, was it through the help of other people or just yourself, of this needs to stop, I need help? And what did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I got to a point where I just hated anything that had to do with sport.
Oh,
because I, you know, really had broken myself down so far. And so there was just a real, like, a very, very dark moment that I had, like, had to address it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I ended up going into inpatient eating disorder treatment for, a good part of, like, 9 months.
Wow.
And then was, I mean, it was interesting to do that kind of in the midst of racing too. I didn't race while I was in treatment, obviously, but very much, like, had sport on my mind. And in that way, like, I am grateful that I was able to go through that process and then come back to cycling. And I probably raced another 2 or 3 years after that.
Oh, wow.
And then just kind of decided, though, that to fully recover, I, like, had to stop because, eating disorder treatment helped some, but definitely there was a lot of, like, it's just, especially when it's cultural, like, hard. It was hard, at least for me, to, truly break through things. So,
So, I think to different stages in recovery, I kind of want to normalize that for people. Sometimes, you know, we want, if you need help, go get help and have all the hope and faith that this will be your answer and solution. At the same time, there are so many different phases and realization and growth that happens along the way. So you did return to sport. You were recovered in some senses, but maybe not in others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like had gotten kind of out of the darkest hole thanks to some treatment, but it really is challenging when you're kind of like in the same environment that perpetuated a lot of your eating disorder behaviors to keep going too. And some people can get like all the way through it. And I just really needed to step back to fully be able to take that pressure off, I think was a lot of it for me, at least.
Was that a really hard decision for you, or did it feel like the right decision at the time, or was it still very?
At the time, it felt definitely like the right decision. Like I was just ready to try something different.
Yeah.
So I think I was 24 at that stage.
Yeah.
Still on the young side, but also like hadn't done anything other than bike race at that juncture. So it was kind of scary to feel like I didn't know what else my life had to hold, you know, or if anything else, which again, like it is a young thought to be like, oh gosh, my life is over at 24.
I know, but your identity, that was your life for 6 years. That's what you pursued. That's what you did. That was your job. That was your friends. That was your identity. So it's extremely hard to make that shift. And especially if you had never made the shift before in your life, right? Like not many people go through identity crises, you know, every like 2 years or something. Some people do might, but like to really have to like change your life. I think throughout life, we do that. So every time you do it, you'll get more comfortable with it. But your first time at the age 24 being like, I have to change my life. That's a big deal.
Yep.
Yeah. So where did you start? Is that when you were like, go back to school? Like,
So I worked for a nonprofit for 2 years right out of after I stopped racing. A pretty cool organization called World Bicycle Relief that is so tied to the bike industry.
Yeah.
And a humanitarian organization that provides these really cool, like well-built bicycles to folks. So yeah, I got into a bit of that work and through that, like realized how much I loved kind of using my brain. And while I loved this organization's mission, it just started to like rekindle a lot of the things that I was like truly interested in, which I was just a crazy animal lover my entire childhood. So yeah, it was a good motivation to go back to school at that juncture.
Yeah.
Yep. So read Temple Grandin, Animals in Translation, if anybody's heard of that. She is this amazing professor here at CSU and studies animal behavior in the context of her own autism too, which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a big inspiration to come to school and started studying and then, found this field of wildlife and that was pretty transformative.
I love it. And I just love to, again, I think I'm speaking right now to maybe some younger listeners who might be in a place that you were when you were 24 of like addressing an eating disorder, thinking about what's next, or maybe even that decision to leave sport or transition from college sport to not college sport. And it's like, it can be so scary. What's next? Who am I?
Yep.
And I just, you know, give yourself permission like you did to try something. See what captivates your mind. Read a book. Get a job. It'll unfold before you somehow.
Definitely.
That's kind of what you let happen. You weren't like, instead of being an athlete, I'm going to be this. You just, you know, like you said, kind of going back to your roots. I like animals. I'm going to read this book. Yeah. And it just opened up a whole new world for you.
And I will say too, to those younger listeners, like the way I just stated it was pretty linear and it's just not at all that either.
Yeah.
You know, that was quite a bit of struggle too, in terms of starting to work a bit out of racing. And then I had a hard time letting go of just like exercising a lot in those first year or two, but it was fun to like explore new sports at that juncture. That's kind of when I started to run for the first time and competed in some running races at that time, but just could feel all of those same behaviors and feel like sport was so closely attached that I just needed to let any sort of competitive sport rest for the time being.
So you did participate in running a little bit, but you had to hold yourself back.
Yeah. It was just pretty like clear to me that I've always loved running and I did not want to get to the point. Like at this stage, I still don't really want to ride bikes.
Yeah.
Like it sort of ruined the sport for me. And so I really didn't want to do that with running.
Yeah.
Which was nice to know what I loved and, you know, want to protect that too.
Yeah. Knowing your boundaries.
Yep.
And I have a little bit of a specific nutrition question in regards to that recovery phase, whether it was in treatment or the years after. but you're an animal lover, you were vegetarian as a kid for non-disordered reasons, just how you ate. Throughout recovery, were you able to stay vegetarian? Did, when you were in treatment, did people advise you any differently? How did that go?
Yeah, I think I had started eating meat at some point during, while I was racing bikes. So it was not part of my eating disorder treatment explicitly.
Yeah.
I think just as somebody who has always, especially like for environmental reasons and whatnot, I do still try to eat less meat, but like I also really value a good burger every now and again. And I
you
like.
You do. Okay. So you're not necessarily vegetarian at this moment.
No, not at all.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'd say like I do just try for, just environmental reasons to eat, to reduce my consumption of meat. But like even just 2 days ago, I just had two or three days where I was feeling a little extra tired. And that's always a sign to me that like I need to have a burger or some sort of beef dish, like a steak or.
Yeah.
And it's really like game changing in that regard. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, love that again. Sorry. Every time you talk, I'm like, this is an important message. Just want to like double tap on it for everybody listening. You are allowed to change your style of eating. Just because you're once vegetarian doesn't mean you have to be now. And vice versa. You are allowed to change. Like, just like your identity might have changed from a cyclist to a non-competitive athlete and now to a runner. Like, you don't need to have an eating identity. You don't need to label yourself vegetarian or a vegan or I eat meat. Like, we don't have to have labels to it. You can eat what you like. And when you feel like you need a burger, I'm going to eat a burger.
Yeah.
And on other days, you're like, I can have this meal and get enough protein without meat. Great. If you don't want it, you don't need it. And then other days you feel it and you want it. So I love that flexibility and the fact that you allowed yourself to change. Just because you ate one way as a kid doesn't mean you still have to now.
Yeah. And I think it's just really important to be able to tune in to listening to what your body is asking you for.
Yeah.
And trying to give it that in the moment, especially when you're doing sport and like pushing your body. I mean, always, but yeah, particularly when you're trying to ask a lot from your body.
You have to give it a lot, and that means you have to listen to it too. Yeah. So, okay. So throughout recovery, you had this passion for running, but also really wanted to protect that, not taint it and get it mixed up with eating and things like that. And so you're moving forward with your schooling and career and stuff. So at what point did things shift of like, I want to sign up for races? And you're obviously, you were good from the start. So it was just kind of like, got competitive, you know, or does it feel competitive or does it feel just like play still?
Yeah. I mean, so it has been awesome to be running the last 15 years or so. I've really just like trail running is incredible. It's just fully my happy place. I love all the people that I run with, my dogs. It's just, something that I really, really value. And I'd say just kind of going back to that exploration bit, like what I do love about endurance sport, and it maybe it like falls into the competition category, but just like the opportunity to explore those limits, I think is so cool. Like whether that's just you getting from point A to point B as fast as you possibly can, or, you know, covering some distance that you never would have fathomed beforehand. Like I really like those personal challenges.
Yeah.
And just like, sort of, I think, breaking down any sort of preconceived notion of what I think I can do.
Yeah.
So that's why I love endurance sport and competition, because it just like brings out
the
best in you.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I broke my leg about 4 years ago. I slipped on ice and I couldn't run for, I don't know, I mean, however long it took me to recover from that. But during that period was the first time, because I like couldn't run, that I really reflected on, oh my God, I like truly love this sport so much.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was also a recovery journey where I couldn't exercise and I felt really comfortable not exercising as I recovered and like feeling myself well while I couldn't exercise.
That's great.
So it was just sort of a signal to me that like I was in a good place overall, and that I really missed this thing, like that I just cared a little extra deeply about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, then I read, I can't even remember how I stumbled on it, but Megan and David Roche's Happy Runner book and read that. And I was like, okay, that's what I want to be. Like, if I want to get back into this, like I want to be a happy runner.
Yeah.
And I read that and the principles just aligned so well. And so I felt like if I could have guidance like that being the source of the energy in terms of the guidance I'd be getting, that I thought I could you know, actually compete safely and healthily. So that was a real turning point in terms of coming back.
So did you contact them?
I did, yeah.
Pretty soon after. Yeah. And they took you on as...
Yep. And I've been working with David the last 4 years and it's been incredible. Amazing. So
I'm going to have to, for our listeners, I'm going to have to find the episode, but that's Megan and David Roach, who are running coaches, especially in kind of the ultra and trail world. And yeah, we had them on this podcast. So I'll...
wonderful.
Yeah, well, I'll share the episode number later for people to listen to hear their philosophy. I mean, their company, they call it Some Work, All Play, or maybe that's their podcast that they call that, right? So it's Some Work, All Play.
Their business.
Their business name, Some Work, All Play. And here they have some of, you know, the most amazing and talented and successful distance and ultra and trail runners in the country and some in the world even. And it's with that mindset of some work, all play. And so, like you said, you wanted that fun. I want to get into this and just have fun and explore with it. But then with the right coaching and training, we're also, you know, getting really quite fast as well.
Definitely. And I mean, it was just really helpful too to, you know, share my past with them. And and then in my training logs too, like the emphasis, especially as we got going, was always you did a long run, like make sure you eat a ton. Like you did this extra hard thing, make sure you eat a ton. Just like having that sort of reinforced in training has been really helpful too. But
yeah, they're very positive food encouragers. If you're going to train, you got to eat as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll probably butcher it, but it's something like never eat too little, always eat enough, and sometimes eat too much, I think is. And it's just, I love that. And it's a good guiding principle.
It is. Absolutely. So you're in this much as you, you know, for about 4 years ago started, you know, hiring a coach now and getting into it a little bit more for competition, but also still with that fun mindset, being that happy runner. And you felt that you were confident in a good place with food. And one of your signs with that was that when running was taken away from you, you still fueled and nourished your body. And that was a good sign for you to say, okay, like I'm not going back into old habits, restricting or compensating or anything like that. So you felt confident. As you ticked up training or started doing more races, did you have to shift your nutrition intentionally, you know, to fuel more intentionally? And what were some of the things that you had to start doing or maybe currently do to really stay on top? Because this is ultra running. You got to eat a lot to get through. Yeah. So
100%. Like, I do think just having come into it, like feeling like in a pretty good headspace, it wasn't too hard to just ramp up. I just have been listening to hunger cues. And so like, not really caring like what the volume was, just like making sure it matched sort of my hunger levels. But I think the things that I did consciously change that have been pretty transformative were just the timing of nutrition too.
Yeah.
And being really diligent about that, like never going for a run on an empty stomach anymore. Like I, you know, just won't run fasted ever. Mm-hmm. Or if
ever.
I'm running.
I love that. I just want to highlight that. Ever.
Yeah.
Won't ever.
Yep. It's never like I don't have too much time or, you know, I didn't feel like eating in the morning. It's just like, that's just a full stop. Like I won't. Yeah. I need to eat at least a little something before I go out running.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a big change. If I run more than 75 to 90 minutes, I'm like always bringing fuel with me and being really diligent about fueling like every 20 to 30 minutes if I am running those longer distances.
Yeah.
And then, within 30 minutes of finishing a run too, like always eat something. Mm-hmm. Also, like never, like I was, I think, 2 or 3 minutes late to meet with you because I like had to eat a bowl of cereal after.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was just
you're late because you ate. And that is a totally acceptable reason for me.
Yeah, but just those are sort of the non-negotiables, especially around running. It's like making sure I'm never going into a run hungry, fueling really well during a run, and then immediately recovering.
Yeah.
And then also like shifting my mindset too from that whatever I eat, like within 30 minutes of finishing running, like that's just a post-run snack. And then like I need to eat a meal within an hour and a half or so.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think just being really intentional around that has helped a ton. In terms of like, because my mindset, especially around cycling, like the advice I'd gotten was to go for 3 hour fasted rides and, you know, get home and drink 2 Diet Cokes and take a nap, you know? So it's just like,
oh God.
terrible stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I agree. As a sports dietitian, I agree with everything you just said. And I also want to highlight, you know, I'm somebody who, you know, believe in that concept of like food freedom and intuitive eating as well. And so you might hear me say, you know, there's no food rules. But then there's a little asterisk. There's a little caveat of like, but you have to come up with your own non-negotiables as an athlete. So I don't want to say it's a food rule, but it is kind of like if you're not eating pre and post run, like then that privilege to train at that level is going to be taken away, you know?
Yeah.
Like there are some non-negotiables as an athlete. And I don't say this to create a rule, but it's just you're not going to be able to train in a healthy way if you don't set those boundaries or guidelines or whatever, or rule, I don't care what you call it, boundary, guideline, non-negotiable. But I think the nutrient timing aspect is huge. And also we do have to think about, you know, amount as well. You know, at some point you can't say, oh, I had, you know, a bite of a banana and that's going to be enough. Like we're going to have to get into volume at some point too. But, you know, sometimes it just has to start with checking that box of a non-negotiable. I will eat before every workout or every run. And I do find, again, as somebody who I want athletes to be intuitive, sometimes this can be challenging for them. Well, I wasn't hungry before a run, or I wasn't hungry after my workout. And I heard you say earlier too, you do listen to your hunger, and I think that's wonderful. How do you manage that if sometimes your hunger is telling you, I really don't want that, but yet your non-negotiables that you've set for yourself as an athlete are telling you, I do need to do this? How do you kind of manage that?
Yeah, I guess with some of those things where like I will eat something before I run, or like I have to eat something right after I get back, then I just like I do try to take the decision making out of that too. Mm-hmm. Like just have some preset kind of choices that I like know will meet my needs there. And so that really helps too, because like, okay, there's like two or three things that I can just, I know they sit well on my stomach before I run. I know that they're like calorically dense enough, and yeah, just like kind of what I need. So I think taking the decision making out of it helps a little bit there too. Or like, you know, like I said, the bowl of cereal is like a great post-run snack, and it's just sort of like what I do rather than like thinking about what I want to eat. And then I think about what I want for lunch, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where the intuitive now comes into it. Okay. Do I want something hot or cold or crunchy or salty or whatever? But, you know, and I'm the same way too. So many people are always asking me as a dietitian, like, what should I eat? And I'm like, there's 1,000 things you could choose from, but I'm always like post-workout, I'm like milk, protein shake and bar. Like I just keep it so simple because it's like,
bagels,
it's just,
I don't know.
Pre-workout bagel, a peanut butter sandwich. Like, I have a list of like 4 things. It's like, maybe that sounds boring, but it's because it works. It's thoughtless, appetite wise. Like for my body, many of the athletes we've worked with, we just keep it simple so you don't have to overthink it. And that's what helps make it a non-negotiable. Like this is just what we do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing a few more, just for anybody listening who's like really struggling? What? Tell me what to eat, because they're thinking too much. So you mentioned post-run, you might do a quick bowl of cereal. Anything else of, you know, your 2 or 3 things for pre or post that you go to?
Yeah. Pre-run, I eat a lot of oatmeal. I love bagels and peanut butter and banana. I'd say actually probably those are the things that I like mostly go between pre-run. But then also I do have some Clif bars as like a very backup, you know?
Yeah.
That is like, if I'm in a rush, I could just grab
one
of those too. And then, post-run, I really like eating cereal, and I think I like live off of bagels too. So also like bagels is another thing that I'll eat right after. That's just really easy to like put in the toaster.
Yeah.
With peanut butter and jelly or cream cheese or whatever.
Yeah. Too easy. And if you're not home by a toaster, bagels are still good just as they are too, right? It's kind of portable in many ways, you know? So.
Yep.
Yeah. Too easy.
Yeah. Yogurt is another thing that I'll like plop in there sometimes. So.
Yeah. Too easy. Love it. I love that. So, man, coming up on time. I hate it.
Oh, gosh, that flew by.
I know, doesn't it? Oh, man. I quickly want to chat then about, just as far as running goes, you in January, or was it February, the Black Canyon 100K.
Yep.
That you were second place female, correct? And that's what gave you a golden ticket to the Western States 100, which for anybody who doesn't know, that's a 100-mile race out in California, very tough and rugged conditions, and you can only be in the race when you get a golden ticket, so you place in another qualifying race. So it's really, really special to go. So congratulations.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I just wanted to have a maybe quick chat about, you know, any differences in how you fuel and train, just for how you fuel for daily training as an ultra runner versus like fueling that happens in a 100-mile race or in a 50-mile race. Are there any major differences? You mentioned, of course, like there's the timing aspect. And of course, in a race, you know, we've got to keep up with nutrient timing throughout a race. But any other like things that you really focus on for during your race?
Yeah, I'd say like the same thing applies to pre-run before.
Yeah.
A race too. I just like will be a little bit more conscious of the timing of that.
Yeah.
Pre-run, because like I'll often like throw a bagel in my mouth and then just run out the door. Whereas like we'll probably try to eat that bagel an hour or two ahead of time.
A little more specific.
For a race. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to like be a little bit extra loving to my stomach.
Yeah.
And, you know, GI issues that could arise as a result. But other than that, I actually like train pretty specifically on long runs with race day fueling so that I am really, my body's just used to it. It knows what's to expect and that, so that I can handle the amount of calories that I'm trying to take in during the race.
So your long training run fuel is essentially the same as race day fuel.
It's exactly the same.
Love it.
Exact same stuff that I'm going to be eating and then in the exact same quantities. So I aim for that 100 grams of carbs per hour mark. And yeah, I mean, it's a lot of calories to put in, you know, especially when you're exerting yourself. But with practice, like I've had really good luck with it. And I think it's game changing too, in terms of being able to push hard for for the duration of long races.
Yeah. So I want to repeat that just as a very specific nutrition tip, especially in the case of ultra running, but this can apply to many other endurance sports. Many of these sports nutrition products might have like a gel or chew, a packet of chews, might have 20, 25, 30 grams of carbohydrate in them. And if you read the label, it might even say like consume one gel per 45 minutes of training. And you just mentioned you aim for 100 grams of carbs per hour. And so I just wanted to kind of reiterate that for a lot of these endurance sports, the body can handle 60, 100, 120. And there's a variety, and you might have to test that out, what your body can handle. But to sustain for the high level of performance that you're shooting for and you need, I just wanted to let people soak that in. 100 grams of carbs per hour, because I know there's some people listening that are still struggling to accept, you know, 100 grams in a day or something like that, right? And it's like, we are fueling our body to perform. Carbohydrates fuel that performance. And also just that difference between what sometimes we read on a label or we might see on an Instagram post of 30 grams of carbs per hour can really be challenged based on what sport are we doing? What is the endurance? What how long are we out there? How hard are we pushing our bodies? And that your 100 grams of carbs per hour is absolutely appropriate and needed for what you are doing.
I think personally, it's like a really great place to also just take the decision-making out of the equation, because like as you are running longer and harder, your body is not, like your brain isn't necessarily going to be desiring that amount of fuel as well.
Yeah.
So instead of like having to make the decision of whether to eat or not, just like get used to consistently putting, like, just think of yourself as a furnace too. And you're just like feeding the fire steady, you know?
Yes.
So it's, I really try to not make it a decision either. I just kind of know what I'm going to eat every 20 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I don't ever skip anything or it's just kind of like what's happening. And obviously if you have bigger GI stress, have to maybe stop, fix, reevaluate. But yeah, my experience has been with training your gut like that too. It's pretty cool what your body can do.
I've used that furnace and fire metaphor before as well. And you know, the fire being kind of like your metabolism, you want it to keep, or maybe in your case, we can think of like just performance and your body operating and running. You got to keep adding fuel to the flame. You got to keep adding log, because it's going to keep burning through it. And that's exactly what this during run fuel is, in order for your metabolism to keep burning at the level you want it. Keep the fire going.
Yes.
You keep adding
keep
to it.
Keep the fire burning bright.
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm a very visual person. So I'm like, I'm envisioning Becca running, this fire lighting up inside of her. So I love it. Well, I just wanted to say, Becca, I could probably keep talking to you for hours. This was just, I really appreciate you just really sharing your story. And I know there were probably hundreds of details that we just, you know, glazed over. But I appreciate you being open to talk about it and also being proof of moving on in a way that life is still wonderful, being able to shift, you know, who you are, expand who you are instead of, you know, just kind of the single track identity, to really expanding that and rebuilding a relationship with food that seems really wonderful and healthy, and a relationship with sport as well that doesn't seem to show many remnants of your past. It's part of your story, part of your past, but I would say you're very fierce, fit, and fueled at this point in time. That's my little tagline, if you weren't aware.
I love it. Well, thank you, Lindsay. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And also just thanks so much for providing this avenue to share stories too, because I was reflecting earlier today, like 20 years ago when I was kind of in the midst of all this, 15, 20 years ago, there were no conversations like this being shared too. So I just really appreciate you taking the time to, to share stories and talk about nutrition for female athletes.
For sure. And we hope that more female athletes will, you know, follow in your footsteps currently of just being a happy athlete, fueling fearlessly, and just pursuing, I think, that mindset of exploration and fun with sport and fueling as well. I love it. And Becca, I have a few more quick questions. I always go over time. Real quick, though. I got all flabbergasted here. If there's one food you could eat every single day for the rest of your life and never get sick of it, what would it be?
Oh, just one food.
I know.
Can be like a meal, or does it have to be like a single food?
I don't know. I don't really have rules around this. So just go with your gut.
Okay. Well, the first thing that came to mind was peanut butter. I don't think I could live without peanut butter.
And that is a singular food. So you nailed it on the head there. Yeah. It seems obvious, but you never know. What is your favorite sport to participate in?
Trail running.
And how about as a spectator? What's your favorite sport to watch?
As a spectator? That's a good question. I do like watching baseball, which is maybe a little funny.
Yeah.
But Wrigley Field.
Chicago.
At Wrigley Field specifically.
Yeah.
I'm a Cubs fan and appreciate what they've done to the game recently.
I love that. Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to your roots for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And then final question. If there is another female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to for just being an inspiration, a role model, just somebody you want to give a shout out to for any reason, she can be well known or just in your personal life, who would that be?
Yeah. See, I mean, the first person that came to mind is my friend Jen, who has just been, like an incredible friend joining me for early morning runs and always sharing that love of running, but also kind of academic pursuits and opening kind of me up to the world of just being able to do a lot of things at a high capacity and then with like a smile on your face the whole time. So thanks, Jen.
I love that. Yes. Thank you, Jen, for being a great friend to Becca and another amazing female athlete and role model in this world. So thank you so much, Becca.
Yeah. Thank you, Lindsay. I really appreciate it.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie. Please go check them out, and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action.
head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise. Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide. Or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.